From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I talk with writer Richard Rhodes. His new book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, just won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. Also today, I speak with fiction and science writer David Quammen. His column Natural Acts, published in Outside Magazine, explores the mysteries of the natural world. Rock historian Ed Ward plays some songs by top soul stars who got their start imitating Little Richard. And book critic John Leonard reviews Downriver, The New Mystery by Lauren Esselman. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. One of the members of the crew that dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima thought the bomb looked like an elongated trash can with fins. It was 10.5 feet long, 29 inches in diameter, and weighed 9,700 pounds. When it exploded over the city of Hiroshima in 1945, it brought the world into a new era of science and a new era of warfare. My guest Richard Rhodes is the author of the new book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, a history of the science, politics, and human drama behind the first nuclear weapons. The book won a 1987 National Book Award. This week, it won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. I spoke with Rhodes earlier today from station KCUR in Kansas City. He told me why he wanted to write this book.
I had a political reason, and I also had a literary reason. Politically, it seemed to me that I might try to make some contribution to the movement to deal with the whole issue of nuclear weapons. And as I thought that through, I realized I really wasn't someone who might march in the streets or carry signs, but I write books, and that I might somehow, by writing about how all this began, shed some light on where we are today. In terms of literary issues, here was what is perhaps the great tragic epic of the 20th century, mankind inventing the means of its own destruction. And I didn't see, looking through the literature, that anyone had tried to tell the entire story on that epic scale that it seemed to me it deserved.
You write that to blame the scientists for nuclear weapons confuses the message with the messenger. Would you explain that?
Well, they didn't invent nuclear energy any more than earlier physicists invented electricity. It was there always lurking in matter, waiting for a time when we had reached a point of understanding of how the world works to prize it out. Robert Oppenheimer said once to his physicists right after the end of the Second World War that the deep things in science, he said, are not found because they're something we want. They're found because they're there to be found. So these men didn't inflict this energy upon us. They simply found a way to prize it out, and it became then a political issue and is still a political issue. So I don't think we should blame the physicists.
You actually, I think, paint a very poignant picture of the young physicist who worked on the creation of the atom bomb. These are physicists who were used to living in a very theoretical world. And suddenly they were thrust into a very real world, a world in which they were creating the most destructive bomb in the history of man. And they really weren't used to that kind of work.
Physics before World War II was such an arcane science that one physicist, a friend of mine, said that when he got his PhD in physics, he would go to a cocktail party and someone would say, "What do you do?" And he would say, "I'm a chemist." Here then, suddenly, they were thrust into one of the darkest and most painful parts of the world, working on weapons of terrible mass destruction. And they felt that contrast keenly. They felt their responsibility to try to understand what they were doing and what the moral issues were quite keenly, even in the context of a brutal war when everyone in this country was trying as hard as possible to find ways to bring it to an end.
Many of the physicists who were working on the bomb had strong political feelings, feelings about how the bomb should or should not be used. Physicist Niels Bohr actually wrote to FDR that in order to prevent eventual nuclear war, that the U.S. should share its secrets with the Soviet Union to prevent what he called competition grounded in insecurity. Did he actually go so far as to share some of the information about the bomb with his Soviet counterparts?
No, although I think Winston Churchill was afraid he might. And I must clarify, I think that Bohr has been unfairly accused of contemplating sharing the secrets of the technology with the Soviet Union. He never did propose that. He talked to Roosevelt, he talked to Churchill about the necessity of understanding that this weapon was going to be eventually a common danger to all mankind, which is what it's become. And that sitting down before the arms race that would otherwise be inevitable began, Mike forestalled that arms race. He had the hope that these leaders in wartime who had seen such devastation, who understood what that devastation meant, might be able to sit down and agree on some sort of controls before the whole thing started, which, of course, is not what happened. So Bohr wasn't proposing sharing the secrets of the bomb such as they were. He was proposing sharing the fact that such a weapon would soon exist and trying to deal with the political consequences of that weapon.
Richard Rhodes is my guest. He's the author of the book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. You describe what it was like for the physicists when they viewed the first bomb test, when they viewed their theory actually going off in practice. Now, they really didn't know what to expect, and I think the point that really brings that home is the dollar wager that they all made with each other.
Yes. Well, there was at least a very, very small possibility that some unknown physical effect might lead to this uranium, or rather plutonium bomb that was tested in the desert in southern New Mexico, igniting the atmosphere and blowing up the world. And although they knew that the chances were extremely remote because they had worked the numbers thoroughly over and over again, there was still the vague possibility. So in that sort of gallows humor spirit, they had a betting pool on the size of the bomb and what might happen.
And the bets ran, the one physicist bet that it would be a 300-ton explosion, and someone else said, no, it would be the equivalent of 45,000 tons. It just really seemed to me they really had no idea
That had a lot to do with the kind of technology. It was a whole new way of setting off a massive material, and they just weren't sure how efficient the design would be. In fact, I noticed that the bomb that was tested in New Mexico was about 4 kilotons smaller in yield than the one that was exploded, supposedly identical, over Nagasaki. So there was some variety there.
They wanted to actually be able to see the bomb going off. How are they equipped to view? Some of them were actually wearing welder's masks. Did they have kind of protection?
Well, Edward Teller had done his numbers carefully and thought the bomb might be more explosive than it turned out to be. So he brought along, in the middle of a cold desert night, and 20 miles away he was stationed, he brought along a bottle of suntan lotion and covered himself with it and passed it around. It was rather chilling to the New York Times reporter who was there to see these famous scientists in the darkness of the night putting on suntan lotion.
Well, Teller, you quote Teller as saying, "We were told to turn our faces away from the blast, but we wanted to look the beast in the eye."
Right. Yes, indeed. Several, Teller described the effect of the bomb going off once he pulled off his welder's glasses as being rather like drawing heavy drapes on a flood of morning sunlight. Another physicist, Philip Morrison, noticed more not the light, which he said we all expected a very bright flash of light, but the fact that although Morrison was 5 miles away, he said it felt as if someone had just thrown open the door on a hot oven.
There's a quote from one of the physicists, I. Rabi, that you use in your book, and I was wondering if I could ask you to read that quote for us. This is one of the physicists describing what he saw when the first bomb test.
Maybe we could call this a memorial. Dr. Rabi died yesterday in New York City at the age of 89. This is what he wrote the morning of the test at Trinity Site in New Mexico, July 16th, 1945. "We were lying there very tense in the early dawn, and there were just a few streaks of gold in the east. you could see your neighbor very dimly. Those 10 seconds were the longest 10 seconds that I ever experienced. Suddenly, there was an enormous flash of light, the brightest light I have ever seen or that I think anyone has ever seen. It blasted, it pounced, it bored its way right through you. It was a vision which was seen with more than the eye. It was seen to last forever. You would wish it to stop. Altogether, it lasted about 2 seconds. Finally, it was over, diminishing, and we looked toward the place where the bomb had been. There was an enormous ball of fire which grew and grew, and it rolled as it grew. It went up into the air in yellow flashes and into scarlet and green. It looked menacing. It seemed to come toward one. A new thing had just been born, a new control, a new understanding of man, which man had acquired over nature.
I think there was really quite a range of emotional reactions that the physicists experienced when they saw their creation actually explode. What was that range of emotion?
I think everything from hope to terror, because of the magnitude of the explosion, because it seemed to go on rolling and echoing back and forth from the mountains that framed this flat, high piece of desert land. Hope because they had all, or at least the most thoughtful among them, had come to understand even at that early date that this weapon was going to bring an end to all-out world war, which it has done, I think, and that it was going to force the nation states with all the belligerence of their political system that led to war after war after war over the 200 years since the nation state really came into existence. It was going to force the nation states to find some accommodation with each other, as in fact, again, I think it has. They knew that then, and so there was a measure of hope in what they were doing, even though they also knew that these weapons would very shortly destroy hundreds of thousands of human lives.
You write in depth about the targeting committee who chose the sites in Japan that the bombs would be dropped on. What kind of guidelines was the targeting committee given?
They were instructed to look for a city that was flat enough and open enough in its territory and undamaged enough that the effects of the bomb could be measured in a real battle situation. It was a painful piece of ambiguity all during the Second World War about targeting our bombers. We had originally began as with an Air Force that was intended to be used for precision pinpoint bombing, and that myth was maintained really throughout the Second World War, and I think there are probably many Americans who still believe it. But the bomb sites were not accurate enough, and the bombers couldn't get in position accurately enough to drop bombs precisely. This was particularly true in Japan, where the B-29s were flying it up where the jet stream was. The jet stream was apparently discovered at that point, and it blew the planes off course. We simply couldn't bomb the aircraft factories and the ball-bearing factories that we hoped we could. And rather than give up the use of a multi-million-dollar weapons system, strategic bombers, we decided to bomb cities in general on the sort of theory that if you're going to destroy a factory, well, the workers are kind of soldiers in the factory, so they're combatants too. So from 1939, when we appealed to the belligerents, Germany and England, not to bomb cities, to 1945, when we were bombing Japanese cities with firebombs and actually destroyed totally 66 Japanese cities by the end of the Second World War, we had reached a point where targets were the center of cities, not factories on the margins or anything else. And in that baleful spirit, the targeting committee tried to find a place where the bomb, one for each city, could be dropped to demonstrate what sort of damage it would cause. And Hiroshima was the first choice of the first meeting of the first of the target committee, and continued to be throughout.
What made Hiroshima the first choice?
Well, Hiroshima was a delta city. It's the place where the river, the Ota River, fans out into seven tributaries. it's flat, and it was there, simply. It was still there. Hiroshima had not been bombed yet. We had firebombed and destroyed so many cities that it was difficult to find targets that met the criteria that were proposed. So it was chosen because it was available and because it was still undamaged.
Well, I want to talk with you about the actual dropping of the bomb, but first we're going to take a short break. Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Richard Rhodes, who is the author of the book The Making of the Atomic Bomb. It just won a National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. Earlier this year, it won a National Book Award. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Richard Rhodes is my guest, the author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb. One thing that's always amazed me seeing pictures of the atomic bomb is how small it looks.
Well, yes, and in fact, the actual plutonium core of the Nagasaki bomb was about the size of an orange. It doesn't take, I mean, there's so much energy locked up in matter, it doesn't take very much of it to produce an enormous explosion.
The bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima came equipped with graffiti, little messages that people in America wrote on the tail of the bomb. Who wrote the graffiti and what did it say?
I wasn't able to find out what it said. I gather some of it was obscene. Some of it said, up the emperor, or whatever, the sort of thing that soldiers and mechanics would write on the tail of a bomb they were about to drop. That was a pretty common experience during the Second World War. We took those things personally. There's a photograph that shows the Fat Man bomb, the Nagasaki bomb, that with graffiti on the tail, but unfortunately the words aren't quite resolvable. I guess it's lost to history.
You quote the description that Paul Tibbetts, a pilot and the group commander for the raid on Hiroshima, you quote him describing dropping the bomb and then flying past as the bomb exploded. I'm going to ask you to read that quote.
Yes, Tibbetts directed the training of the bombing group and was, in fact, the pilot for the Hiroshima mission. After the war, he wrote, this is just as the bomb has fallen from the bomb bay of the B-29 at 31,000 feet. I threw off the automatic pilot and hauled Enola Gay, that was the name of the plane, Enola Gay into the turn. I pulled anti-glare goggles over my eyes. I couldn't see through them. I was blind. I threw them to the floor. A bright light filled the plane. The first shock wave hit us. We were 11 and a half miles slant range from the atomic explosion, but the whole airplane cracked and crinkled from the blast. I yelled, "Flak!" thinking a heavy gun battery had found us. The tail gunner had seen the first wave coming, a visible shimmer in the atmosphere, but he didn't know what it was until it hit. When the second wave came, he called out a warning. We turned back to look at Hiroshima. The city was hidden by that awful cloud, boiling up, mushrooming, terrible and incredibly tall. No one spoke for a moment, then everyone was talking. I remember Lewis, his co-pilot, pounding me on the shoulder, saying, "Look at that, look at that, look at that." Tom Farabee, who was the bombardier, wondered about whether radioactivity would make us all sterile. Lewis said he could taste atomic fission. He said it tasted like lead.
What had these pilots been told to expect that they would experience when they dropped the bomb?
Well, Tibbetts, first of all, had actually seen the films from the test in the desert and had been thoroughly briefed. He'd made many trips to Los Alamos during the time the bombs were being built. He didn't tell his crews anything until they were out on Tinian Island, 1,500 miles from Japan, just a couple days before the actual bomb run. They were aware that they were going to do something rather unusual because they had been practicing the rather bizarre activity of taking their huge B-29s. The B-29 was the largest bomber ever built up to that time. It had the wingspan almost as large as a football field. taking their B-29s into a sudden 180-degree diving turn that came very close to the stress limits on the wings of the aircraft. This was designed to gain speed and to get them away from the atomic explosion at least 10 miles away between the time the bomb left the bomb bay and the time it exploded 1,800 yards above ground. So they knew something was up, and they were getting away from something that must be an extraordinarily powerful explosion. But they didn't know that the bomb was an atomic bomb until they were actually airborne and flying the Hiroshima mission. Then Tibbetts told them, and they were understandably awed.
Was that information withheld so that they wouldn't betray any secrets, or so that they wouldn't be too scared to fly the mission?
No, it was secrets that were involved, yes. This entire program, which involved the work of 100,000 people in the United States, was maintained with truly extraordinary secrecy throughout the Second World War.
We discussed a little bit the range of reactions that the physicist at Los Alamos felt after the first test of the atom bomb went off. What was the range of reactions when reports came back to Los Alamos that the bomb had actually exploded on Hiroshima?
Some of the physicists feeling that they had contributed to an early end to a bloody and brutal war celebrated. They went out to dinner at the La Fonda Hotel in Santa Fe. Some were so shocked to realize that what they had done had killed 140,000 human beings that they went out in the bushes and threw up. That was the range. They were all, I think, stunned by the reality of what had not been quite real before, as we all are when something that we've worked on suddenly has massive consequences.
Your book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, has just won two very prestigious awards. I think what makes this book important is not only the incredible details that you've managed to put together in telling the complete story of the making of the atomic bomb, but also the fact that a lot of the main players in this drama are in the latter years of their life and won't be around to tell their story much longer.
It's been a saddening and moving experience to meet these men and then to discover later that they have died. I've now seen the deaths of three of the people that I've met and interviewed for the book. Yesterday, as I mentioned earlier, Isidore Isaac Rabi, one of the great physicists of the 20th century, a wonderful man who ran a great school of physics at Columbia University and who was, to some extent, perhaps the conscience of the atomic scientists, a rabbinical man, a man of great wit and great humor, and a man who didn't easily suffer fools, but was part and parcel of all this activity, and now he's gone to us, he's lost to us. This story is on the cusp of history, and maybe that's why it still has so much force for us, because it happened only yesterday. I was 8 years old. I remember vividly the photograph in the Kansas City Star, where I live in Kansas City, Missouri, of the mushroom cloud over Hiroshima. And yet, so much has happened since then. It's had such enormous consequences for the world that it also must seem a little bit as if this has always been with us.
What surprised you most in the research of this book? You knew something of the story of the atom bomb before you started to write the book, I'm sure. But in actually finding out all the details and doing the investigations that you did and speaking to the people who were involved in the making of the bomb, who you spoke to, what elements really surprised you?
I think, there's something that something large and something perhaps that's just a part of the history of the story. Maybe they're connected. I went into this with a very strong feeling that there might be no hope for us all. The arms race is certainly something that can lead anyone to feel that way if they're inclined to be pessimistic. And what I discovered is that whole other side that some of the great physicists who worked on this weapon had thought their way through to even before the end of the war, the side that although this is danger for all mankind, it also in a paradoxical way is a source of great hope because it is and has and I think will continue to force the nation states to find another way to settle their grievances. that connected to something curious. One of the heroes of the whole story is a Danish physicist named Niels Bohr, who was one of the two probably greatest physicists with Einstein of the 20th century. I was fascinated to discover that Bohr's essential way of looking at some of the very basic physics that he did as a scientist traces very directly back to his early reading of Soren Kierkegaard, of all the strange people you might think connected with Bohr's realization that the atom was of a certain design, for example, is connected with his understanding of some of Kierkegaard's ideas about religion. And to find the preeminent 19th century philosopher of existentialism, of angst, of anxiety and dread, deeply, deeply connected to the story of the bomb and of the release of nuclear energy into the world was an extraordinary connection that I was fascinated by.
You said that there was something kind of light or almost trivial. Is that the word you use?
Trivial, but I mean the Kierkegaard connection is perhaps not central to things. But it's a rather deep connection that I had no one had come across before.
Do you feel changed by having found out what you did about the bomb?
Very much so. Very much so. Because I came away with this with a sense of hope. Came away with a feeling that this might have been one of the finest things that ever happened to our species.
Yet you say it in the end of the book, the necessity now is to begin to dismantle the death machine.
The death machine referring to the entire vast overkilling mechanism that we've managed to put together over the last 42 years because we were so afraid, because the nation states give up their sovereignty so with such reluctance. So grudgingly, we have built and continue to build. So the arms race, in fact, is ongoing, and I think that's the danger now. I think the danger to us all is the danger of accident, either mechanical accident, mechanical failure, the computers fouling up, or the kind of accident by which World War I began, where things just got out of hand and nobody quite knew how to stop them. That, I think, is our risk now, not the risk of someone declaring war.
Well, I want to congratulate you on the National Book Critics Circle Award that you just
won
for your new book. And I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your time with us today and for talking with us about the making of the atomic bomb. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Richard Rhodes. His book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, just won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Last November, it won the National Book Award. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with jazz saxophonist and clarinetist Bob Wilbur. This Saturday, he'll lead a 50th anniversary tribute to Benny Goodman's 1938 Carnegie Hall concert. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with novelist and science writer David Quammen. He writes the column Natural Acts in Outside Magazine. He explores the mysteries of odd-looking animals and plants, but he doesn't want the column to be a biological freak show. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles soul singers who launched their careers with imitations of Little Richard. And book critic John Leonard reviews Downriver, the new mystery novel by Lauren Esselman. It's his eighth in a series featuring the Detroit detective Amos Walker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Mara Liasson in Washington. Japanese Prime Minister Noboru Takeshita began his first state visit to Washington today. Takeshita is expected to press for removal of the remaining $165 million in U.S. duties on Japanese electronics products in a dispute over trade and computer chips. He will also try to cool growing anger over America's record $59 billion trade deficit with Japan. In the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip today, Israeli troops shot and killed another Palestinian protester, and Israeli authorities barred UN Representative Marek Golding from entering refugee camps in the territories. The BBC's Tim Llewellyn reports.
The United Nations Undersecretary General Marek Golding tried two entrances to Gaza's biggest refugee camp, Jabalia. But at both, he was turned back by Israeli soldiers. The same thing happened when he tried the nearby beach camp. At a third camp, Bughazi, the presence of a large and restive Palestinian crowd gathered just inside the camp convinced Mr. Golding that the situation was too volatile to risk taking in any visiting party, however neutral. Mr. Golding is in the region to investigate, on behalf of the Security Council, the safety and protection of Palestinians in the occupied territories. And the incidents illustrate Israel's high sensitivity to the issues and to his visit, and the extreme tension and hostility inside the camps.
Tim Llewellyn in Jerusalem. 231 people died in commercial airline accidents in the U.S. last year. That's the highest number of fatalities since 1982. The National Transportation Safety Board released the new statistics today. The head of the Air Transport Association of America, William Bolger, said his industry was not disappointed by the report's conclusions.
Sure, it's safe to travel by air. It's been become increasingly safe most years. We had a slip back in 1987 compared to 1986, but even 1987 goes on record as the seventh best year in safety since they've been recording accident statistics.
Although commercial airline accidents and fatalities increased last year, they dropped for private flyers. Fatalities there declined from 955 in 1986 to 788 last year. President Reagan signed a proclamation today honoring the 59th birthday of slain civil rights leader Martin Luther King, Jr. King's birthday will be celebrated Monday, a national holiday. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
In signing the proclamation, the president, who initially opposed making King's birthday a national holiday, said it is thanks to King's strength of character and his God-given talents that the dream he spoke about so eloquently will live on forever. Mr. Reagan also used the occasion to point to gains black Americans have made during his administration. One area the president singled out was employment.
Black employment has risen 26% during our expansion. That's more than twice the rate of the job gain of whites. The unemployment rate for black youths has declined dramatically.
Among those looking on as the president signed the proclamation was Dr. King's widow, Coretta Scott King. She said afterwards that, quote, minimal progress for blacks had been achieved during the Reagan administration, but she added that there had been tremendous progress in employment and education. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
Senator Joseph Biden today handed British Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock a bound copy of his speeches and said he told Kinnock to use them whenever he liked. Biden met with Kinnock in London for about 90 minutes today. Revelations that Biden used parts of a speech by Kinnock without attribution forced the Delaware Democrat out of the 1988 presidential race. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 16 points to 1928. Prices were down as much as 52 points at one time today, but recovered in the afternoon. I'm Mara Liasson. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Back in the 50s and 60s, performers from Gene Vincent to Conway Twitty made names for themselves by trying to sound like Elvis. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward says some of the top soul stars started out imitating another rock and roll great, Little Richard.
The birth of rock and roll was loaded with totally original performers, and probably none of them is as much a category unto himself as is Little Richard. Rock and roll is a very hard thing to define, and often you wind up saying what it isn't as much as what it is. It isn't a kind of blues, it isn't a kind of country, and it isn't a lot of other things, but it is Little Richard. Or to put it another way, Little Richard is a pure rock and roll performer. Now, one of the facts about rock and roll is that the people who control the record business are always quite a bit older than the people who buy the records themselves. This means that they never really know if a record is anything like what the kids who will wind up buying it will like. So one of the safest things to do is to find out what the kids like and try to come up with something that sounds exactly like it. There were hundreds of would-be Elvises, and there were also plenty of would-be Little Richards. Take this guy, for instance. Vocal sounds a little forced, and the lyrics to Chani On Chan sound like they were made by a computer programmed with Little Richard records. Chani On Chan came out at the height of Richard's popularity, and fortunately, it was a total flop. No, Federal Records had to find something for James Brown to record that sounded a little more natural. Once Richard retired to go into the ministry, though, the rush was on. King Records in Cincinnati was lucky enough to have a man who really knew his way around, Henry Glover, as a talent scout. And he came back from Navasota, Texas, with his version of the next Little Richard.
Now when a woman gets a good man, every woman wants to be a friend. Yes, when a woman gets a good man, every woman wants to be a friend. But all you women better get your own man. Then your situation's in. Now if you got a real good man, don't advertise what your man can do. I said if you got a good man, honey, don't go around advertising what he can do. Cause if you advertise too much, baby, your best friend will try your man out too.
That's Joe Tex. Another Woman's Man doesn't sound quite as much like Richard as You Little Baby-Faced Thing, which was Tex's first record for King, but doesn't sound as much like the Joe Tex who would rise to fame in the 60s as it might either. Tex was one of those talents who could imitate anyone, but he sounded better as himself. The third of our not-quite-Richards is the weirdest one yet. Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers were a moderately successful soul review who toured the South, and one day they got a break and recorded a number of sides in a studio. The producer was impressed and kept asking them for songs until they ran out. He pressed them for one more, and the group's bus driver announced that he'd like to take a shot. The producer was sure he'd found the next Little Richard when he heard this.
A one, two, three, four. I'm shouting Bama Lama. Way down in Louisiana.
get 10 or 11 more. Steady getting them, ain't I? I love my chicken, baby. Shouting, mama, lama. Well, 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 nobody's gonna say them down. 9 feet and 10 feet, we're going for the field. 9 feet left on a 10 feet a hill. 10 feet turn around and 9 feet green. His teeth fell out and his tongue stayed in. His cat says something.
Shout Bama Lama was a mild hit, but Otis Redding didn't like the way his voice sounded on the record. He knew he could sing better than that, and thank heaven, so do we. No, the original is still the greatest. Even today, skating on the thin ice of self-parody, Little Richard makes a more convincing Little Richard than anyone else around.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Ready, set, go, man, go. I got a gal that I love, so I'm ready. Rock and roll, going to the corner, pick up my sweetie pie. She's my rock and roll, baby, she's the apple of my eye. I'm ready, 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 I'm ready. Rock and roll, all the flat top cats and all the dungaree dogs. I headed for the gym to the sock hop ball. The joints are really jumping, the cats are going wild. The music really set my dear, the crazy style. I'm ready, 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 and I'm ready. Woo! Ready, ready, and I'm ready. Ready, ready, and I'm ready, ready, ready to rock and roll. Hey!
You're listening to Fresh Air. What are the redeeming merits, if any, of the mosquito? Why is the act of sex invariably fatal for some species of salmon? These are the types of questions that inspired David Quammen to write his column Natural Acts, which is published in Outside Magazine. Quammen is one of the leading explainers of the natural world. He won a National Magazine Award for Essays and Criticism. Many of his essays were collected in the book Natural Acts. Quammen leads a literary double life. He's the author of the thrillers The Zolta Configuration and The Soul of Viktor Troncal. His new book is a collection of short stories titled Bloodline, Stories of Fathers and Sons. I spoke with David Quammen from member station KEMC in Billings, Montana. I asked him how he ended up both a novelist and a naturalist.
I started off as a novelist. The first thing I ever published was a novel about 17 years ago, but then I discovered that it was pretty hard to make a living writing novels, unless you were one of the few bestseller people. So I sort of drifted into nonfiction and then eventually into science journalism simply as a way of earning a living, as a way of paying the rent.
Do those two kinds of writing frequently take you in opposite directions?
They take my time and my attention in opposite directions sometimes. During the period of about 3 years when I was writing The Soul of Viktor Troncal, I spent a lot of time reading Russian memoirs, memoirs of KGB defectors, other books about the Soviet Union, Soviet history, Soviet intelligence affairs. And none of that really did me any good in the science writing. I'd work for 3 weeks of each month on the Russian defector novel, and then I'd set that down and go scrambling off and start reading about scorpion biology or the ecology of rainforests or something like that. But the variety was also something that helped to energize me, and I enjoyed it a lot.
Let's talk about your science essays. You've said that you don't want your science essays to be seen as freak shows for unusual insects and animals. Do you think it's tempting to respond to insects and animals as freak shows?
My natural inclination is to write about, go places that no one else wants to go to and write about creatures that no one else wants to think about, the scorpions and the black widow spiders and sea cucumbers and giant snakes and things like that. So there is a tendency, a natural tendency, I suppose, to see these as a freak show, but the species that don't benefit from sort of a natural emotional sympathy that we have toward a large brown-eyed mammal. Those are the species that test not just our likes and dislikes, but matters of principle about how we think of other species.
Well, I learned in one of your essays about spiders that some spiders have 8 eyes, almost like one for each leg. And I also learned in that essay that you are really repulsed by spiders. And I was wondering if you are at once repulsed and attracted to the same things.
Well, in some ways, yes. I am repulsed by spiders. Most of them have at least 8 eyes, and if you've ever looked at a close-up photograph, say, of the face of a black widow spider, it's just a shockingly, bizarrely hideous countenance, at least to our tastes. And I've always had queasy feelings toward spiders, although not toward lots of the other creatures that I write about. For instance, I've always loved snakes and considered them very beautiful animals. I've always detested spiders and thought they were very ugly. But I've been interested in both of them, and I've also been interested in the question of why I have that different reaction, why spiders give me such queasy feelings, and why snakes seem so beautiful. I say also in one of the essays that I don't trust any creature with more than 6 legs and more than 2 eyes. But that's not to say that I'm not fascinated by them.
Yeah, well, you got to draw the line somewhere.
Yeah, I'd like to draw it at 6 legs and 2 eyes, but that leaves some things out that we have to include in.
In your science essays, you're looking at insects, birds, animals. In literature, it's really humans that you're studying.
Well, it is, although it's humans to some extent in my science essays, too. But there is a big difference between the kind of thing I write in fiction and the sorts of science essays that I do. There are probably a couple of themes that turn up again and again in my fiction, but they have no connection with marine iguanas or the bizarreness of life on island, certainly.
In your new book, Bloodline, there's a couple of stories where sons really don't like their fathers because of what their fathers have forced them to do. And there are sons who accidentally shoot their fathers, and and their fathers suffer long, agonizing deaths. Are there images that you had to get out of your system in writing this? Images of sons and fathers not getting along, and of sons accidentally being responsible for the deaths of their fathers?
Well, in some deep sense, probably yes, or the stories wouldn't have gotten written. They're not directly autobiographical. I have, and this book may seem to belie that, but I have a very, very good relationship with my father and always have. So it's not as direct a relationship as that. But I have had an ear for, I guess, the difficulty of relationships between sons and strong-willed fathers over the years. And there's also the question of pseudo-fathers or surrogate fathers, or even fathers in the sense of literary influence. And on one level, the book is, I suppose, about that, about the impulse and necessity for patricide against a writer's literary fathers.
Why would you want to metaphorically kill them off?
Well, I went through a long period when I was just totally immersed in and obsessed with William Faulkner and his work. I'm sure that Faulkner's had that effect on lots of writers, but in a sense, that's what was going on, that one of the fathers who had to die was the literary father, William Faulkner, so that I could escape from this just obsessive, very fruitful, but in some ways stifling impact that he had on me.
So do you feel you've done that?
Well, I hope so. I don't reread Absalom once a year anymore, and I have this book and the Uriah's Letter story out of my system. So yes, yeah, I hope I can keep Faulkner at a healthy distance and in a healthy perspective from now on.
You know, in your writing as a science journalist, you have to deal a certain amount with the predatory nature of animals and insects, and in your literature, you're dealing with guilt. Guilt in father-son relationships, guilt at being responsible for accidental deaths. And it made me think that guilt isn't something that you would deal with as a science journalist, that there isn't that sense of guilt in animals and insects who feed on others.
Well, there certainly isn't that sense of guilt, although some people would like to see it there. There has been, over the years, a tendency to see predators as enemies of human interests. I mean, all the killing of wolves and of cougars that went on early in this century, that's done a lot of harm over the years, that sort of a view.
You're living in Montana now. What drew you there?
At the beginning, trout. It was as simple as that, a one-word answer, trout. I came up here in 73 after graduate school for the trout fishing. I'd never been in the state of Montana, but I knew that there were a lot of rivers up here, and the rivers were cold and clear and full of trout. And I stayed for other reasons. I don't trout fish much at all anymore, but I discovered the great wild, good-hearted redneck ethos that Montana possesses, and that combined with the snow and the solitude is what's kept me here.
Is there a big refugee community comprised of people like yourself who have fled from cities or suburban communities?
There is, yeah. There are lots of people who fled New Jersey and New York and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and are now very dyed-in-the-wool Montanans. But I should say that it's cold and miserable and lonely up here, and other people probably would not enjoy it.
Right, I get the message. Keep out. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your science essays and your fiction.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
David Quammen's new book of short stories, Bloodline, is published by Grey Wolf. A new collection of his nature essays, titled The Flight of the Iguana, is due out soon. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
We're following the visit of the Japanese Prime Minister to Keshta to Washington today. Also, a report on the Sony Corporation saying that it will no longer make its beta video tape players. They're going to make VHS, which had been the competing system. Also, a talk with the Surgeon General, Dr. Everett Koop.
What are you going to talk about?
We're going to talk about a less controversial problem than AIDS or abortion, which he's usually quoted on. This is about hearing loss. Dr. Everett Koop has been wearing hearing aids for the past couple of years, and he's very concerned about people taking care of their own hearing impairment.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Down River. It's the latest in Lauren D. Esselman's pithy crime series about Detective Amos Walker, set in the Motor City.
It's tough being a hard-boiled, wisecracking, big-city private eye. As cynical as Sam Spade, as sad as Philip Marlowe, as ambivalent as Lou Archer. You have to love and hate your city at the same time, and drink a lot, and your sex life is lousy. Amos Walker of Detroit, in Lauren D. Esselman's crime novels, is the second best private eye in American fiction today. The very best is V.I. Warshawski of Chicago in Sarah Paretsky's crime novels. After these two, in no particular order, come Spencer of Boston from Robert Parker, Scudder of New York from Lawrence Block, and Stoner of Cincinnati from Jonathan Valen. Samson of Indianapolis used to be fun too, but Michael Z. Lewin moved to England. Amos Walker is almost iconic. The loner on the urban range, the last romantic in a corrupt world, a combination of St. George, St. Francis, and sweet and sour Parsifal, or a mixed grill of Quixote, Galahad, and Robin Hood, or an omelet of vigilante, philosopher of justice, psychotherapist, and killing machine. In Esselman's eighth Walker novel, Down River, Walker undertakes an investigation, 20 years after the fact, of a robbery and murder that occurred during the Detroit race riots of 1967. His client is the big and black DeVries, who could have been a pro basketball player if he hadn't gone downriver to prison for a murder he didn't commit. Walker must return to the passions of past history, disturb the uneasy truce between blacks and whites in Detroit today, sort out police corruption then and now, make sense of the part being played in this mess by a maverick car manufacturer, half Iacocca and half DeLorean, while at the same time explaining everything to an out-of-town Indian whose people, including the first Cadillac, were around in Michigan long before the blacks and whites started hating and killing one another. The surprises are bloody, and so are the jokes, but downriver satisfies in other ways. Cars are important, as they always are in a Nesselman novel about Walker, because cars are what Detroit's all about, the factories, the unions, and the money that builds itself a city within the city. And Detroit is Walker's central nervous system. So are race relations important. The riots of 1967 are as crucial to Esselman as the Civil War was to Faulkner, the wound that never heals. Organized crime and bad food and soul-destroying modern architecture are fixtures of the series, and the Indians show up often too, because, like Walker, they are dignified losers. Above all, in Downriver, we learn things about sex, money, class, work, and politics out there in an objective reality that seems almost to have disappeared from modern novels by graduate students of the dinky moral qualm and the third-rate identity crisis. Private eyes like Walker are the best social critics in America today. They see the worst, find out why it happened, and know how to hold a splendid grudge. Satisfaction guaranteed.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and he's a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Downriver, the latest Amos Walker novel by Lauren D. Esselman. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Kate Clinton. She's a lesbian feminist stand-up comic. She got her start at women's festivals and has since played many of the country's top comedy clubs. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the new recording of Akhenaten, the recent opera by composer Philip Glass. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss the language of postmodernism. So I hope you can join us, and we'd like to welcome two stations new to Fresh Air, WIUM in Macomb, Illinois, and KCHU in Valdez, Alaska. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.